Thank you. My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. But you don't have to take my word for it. I've been diagnosed by a psychiatrist, psychologist, social workers, clergymen, lawmen, friends, neighbors, a wife, even my dog now. So I come here honest. Okay, the and my dad was a school teacher, and when I was real little, he sold it. He quit teaching school and he bought this little farm in northern Oklahoma, which was never supposed to have been a farm to start in with. It was grass country, buffalo grass, you know. And he knew nothing about farming, nothing. The only thing he ever raised is Johnson grass and limestone rocks. So I could see, you know. He could quote Shakespeare backwards and forwards, but he never did learn how to sharp a plow, sure. And I hated that farm. I hated that with dire passion. And it was during the Dust Bowl, too, by the way. And I remember even in the old farmhouse, the dust would come up through the cracks in the floor. And my mother would use burlap sacks trying to seal the windows off, keep the dust out. It didn't do any good. He had this old, I don't know, you older guys would know what I'm talking about, an old S12 tractor on that. I had them old steel wheels on it with lugs. If you didn't plow ground, it's okay. If you're on an Oklahoma hard pan, it's like riding on a sidewalk, you know. In fact, people with hemorrhoids didn't dare ride. You know, along about that time, somewhere on there, I was parent ordered into the Southern Baptist Church. And Lord, I've never seen such a thing. You know, they hired this preacher, I know, just to put me on a guilt trip every Sunday morning. You know? No matter where I get in that church, I'd try to hide, but he'd point that old big finger at me, you know. And he said some of the craziest things you ever heard. He said, if you looked at a woman with lust in your eyes and you committed adultery in the eyes of the Lord, then you're just gonna burn in hell forever and ever and ever. Oh, God. I'm looking around that church, I'm sitting in every row. Especially when I looked at the preacher's daughter, she was the fairest of all, you know. I looked at her, them flames that just engulfed me, you know. And I hated school. I hated everything about that. And a big break came along, World War II started, and I got to join the Navy. And boy, I got off that farm. By the way, all my older brothers had... As soon as they got big enough to pack a pillowcase, they bailed out and they left me on that farm. So when I got to join the Navy, I was seventh at it. I was getting 50 cents a day working on this farm. God damn, we got in the Navy and they paid me $50 a month. Three hots and a flop, you know. That was really living. And after I got out of boot camp, they sent me to New Orleans. Well, actually, to Algiers is a little city across the river from New Orleans, and the Navy had what they call a receiving station. You'd go there to get further orders out of there, and you know, I never drank a beer in my life, and I never had a drink in my life, and I heard all the big boys talking about beer, you know, boy, I couldn't wait to get a cold beer, and I thought it might taste like a vanilla milkshake. I got over that 9 hours of a beer, and you know what it was? It was a Lone Star State beer. I think you got to be a fourth generation Texan to be able to drink that stuff, you know. I couldn't drink it. It's just too terrible. But I heard somebody order rum and coke, and that sounded a little better. So I ordered a rum and coke, and I had enough coke in the rum, but I didn't taste the rum, I guess. It went down really good. For you young guys, that's Coca-Cola, not the stuff you're used to. Okay. But they told me earlier, they said to get a room early because if you wait, you're not going to get a room. I couldn't believe it. But I got over, you know, and there's nothing going. I went out to Lake Cross train, came back, went to a double length movie, and by the time I was over, I came back out on the street, and I couldn't believe it. I don't know where these people come from. They come out of the woodwork. I've never seen so many people. And so anyway, I ordered this rum and coke, you know, about three or four of them, and I was in New Orleans, was going around and around, and I finally down to my hotel room. And you're not going to believe this, but you know, I'm in that lobby, and there's about 8 or 10 girls sitting in there. They didn't have many clothes on them. I think they called them halters or something. They'd be overdressed in church today, but back then I was kind of underdressed, okay. And I was drunk. And it didn't, even an old country boy like me, it didn't take me long to realize they was like the seventh best tradition of AA. They were self-supporting with their own contribution. Anyway, two of the older ones got in a fight over me, the ugly one took me up the room, you know. I thought, boy, them grab dodgers could see me back on the farm now. I'm a man's man. I'm a real man. I then got drunk here and wound up here. But the next morning when I woke up and threw up. That was my M.O. for the next 30 years of my drinking. And I wouldn't go back down the lobby. I was afraid these vultures would be down. So I crawled down the fire escape and I got back to the receiver place and I jumped in the shower. I tried to scrub all my sins off and it didn't work. And I felt bad all day long. I felt terrible. And I got ashore that night, went in this bar, and this guy didn't even ask. He just had a rum coke out there. And boy, this is living. I'm a real man, you know. And I drank that, you know, and all my sins disappeared. And the guy told me, said, real sailors don't go to those kind of houses. You know, there's thousands and thousands of women in New Orleans. All you got to do is buy one a drink and smile at them. Sure enough, she come in and sat down by me, you know. She smiled at him, I smiled at her, and I bought her a drink. And seemed to me like she was more anxious to get to the hotel room than I was, you know. Next morning I woke up, she was gone, and so was my money. She was self-supporting through my contribution. That's the kind of way it went, you know. And anyway, I know I don't have too long. I'm trying to get 30 years of drinking in a few minutes. But anyway, fast forward, they sent me to Boston. I caught a ship out of Boston, an old cargo ship. And what they do, they drug these old derelict tramp steamers out of mothballs in World War II because they didn't have enough ships, you know. And this army had a station up there off of Greenland somewhere. And we took mostly dog food. But anyway, we got out to sea and it was cold and rough and rough. And once in a while the ship would explode in the distance and you hear destroyers dropping depth charges. And I was scared to death. I mean, I was scared. This old chief came by with a cup of coffee and he said, he knew I was scared. He said, you know, don't. He said, think of this. He said, we're hauling dog food. He said, all them ships over there, they're hauling ammunition and oil. And there's no respectable submariner going to waste a torpedo on us. And they had us out the edge of the convoy, by the way. And that made me feel better. I got a little sleep at night. But I found out later the reason they had us on the edge of the convoy. If they sent a torpedo over there, they hope it mitigated instead of thanks, Chief. Anyway, that's kind of the way it was, you know, in the Navy. In World War II especially, you know. And, you know, actually, when your last night ashore, you didn't know whether you were going to come back or not, so we drank a lot. And in Boston, you get 12% Carling's Ale for 10 cents a glass. And for 50 cents, I get just as drunk. I can get real drunk on 50 cents. From there, I caught a seagoing tug. It was a ship that could tow ocean vessels, and it towed big barges. We came around to the west coast, and we went to Pearl, and come to think of it, I was restricted when we got to Pearl because I'd got a little trouble in San Francisco before we left. Some of them skippers is narrow-minded, you know. It just is nice to see you have a good time, you know. Especially if they want you to come back on time. That's the main thing, you know. Narrow-minded. But anyway, we got on out, and I spent the rest of World War II on that seagoing tug. And what we would do when they'd secure an island, we'd take these barges and we'd haul supplies up to the next station. And we did get in the second invasion of the Philippines, and we got into D-Day plus 10 on Okinawa. You know, a lot of people don't know, but we lost more sailors at Okinawa than we lost almost the rest of the war. It was Japanese came out, what's called these kamikaze airplanes, and all one reason to sink a ship. They just gave them fuel to get out there. They didn't give them any fuel to get back. There's suicides, you know, and there's a lot of them. Anyway, the historians might correct me, but back in we was down in Lady Gulf in the Philippines, and back in August of 45, and I was around a whaleboat and taking guys over to the shore to see the movie. Coming back, all the searchlights went on. They had battleships and carriers and cruisers and every ship you could think of, and the searchlights came on. And we thought, well, there's another air raid. And then we heard somebody hollering, the war is over. The war is over, you know. We thought we'd go back to the States the next day, but that wasn't quite the way it worked. We went on to Tsingtao, China, and the Imperial Japanese Army surrendered during Tsingtao, and it was too rough for landing craft to beat, so they put them on barges, and then on the tug, we tore them back out to the ships and sent them back to Japan. And it was pitiful. Those guys, you know, they got no veterans benefits. In fact, it was a shame when they got back to Japan. They got back to Japan and run and hide because it was a shame, you know, because they lost the war. And first of all, when they got down to the pier, they put them in this barbed wire entanglement. They sprayed it. They didn't take their clothes off. They sprayed it with DDT. Oh, my God. 200 at a time, they probably sprayed down it. But anyway, and I was reserve, and when you build up so many points, you get discharged. And so I got my points. This guy came out and told me I had my points in, so I come back to the States, and we got into San Diego, and what they do, they would send you back to the place where you're recruited. Well, I was recruited in Oklahoma City, so they sent me back to Norman there for discharge. And I went back up my little old dad still had the farm, and it was still just as bad as it ever was. But anyway, I went back up there, and at that time they had what they call a 52-20 club. You could draw $20 a week for 52 weeks, but you had to put in for, application for a job. So we put in for things like deep sea diver. It's in Oklahoma, okay? High mountain rescue team, you know. We put in for something that damn sure didn't have in Oklahoma, you know. During that time, I'd done something that was probably the most stupid thing that anybody ever done. I ran out with a 16-year-old girl. I took her across the state line into Texas. And that was bad enough. But her dad was a deputy sheriff. And her dad and her uncle caught up with us in a motel room. And I remember, they left me for dead, I know. One of them said, castrate the son of a bitch. And I said, don't kill him. We're in Texas. We're going to get back to Oklahoma. You know, kill him back in Oklahoma. And, you know, all the good things, you know. And I was out of it 50 days. And this hotel manager called my dad, and he came down and got me. He took me to South Texas for some friends down there. He didn't want me back in Oklahoma. And, he said, Bob, you drink too damn much. You're going to have to quit drinking. And I said, Dad, I quit. And I meant it. I said, I'm never going to take another drink as long as I live. And he probably hadn't even got out of the sitting there before I had drunk. See, I was already an alcoholic and didn't know it, didn't realize it. And I didn't need that drink to get well, you know. And alcoholics are real smart. They take the same poison to get well if it's sick to get them sick. That's like one diabetic calling out of nothing saying, Dad, just got this brand new 10-pound sack of sugar, come over and my wife is slick. Makes about as much sense, you know. But I got back up in the... I went to work in oil fields in 1946, the later part. They had a steel strike, if you remember that. You're old enough, they had a bad steel strike, and if you was working with steel, you was out of a job. And actually, I went broke down there, spent all my money in the bar. And I was on the highway headed for Oklahoma, and I had on just a pair of khaki breeches and a khaki jacket, and it started to sleep. And I didn't know at the time that I had pneumonia. And these cars just going by, they wasn't stopping, you know. And so I finally just said, well, I'm just going to lay down here in the ditch and die because I knew I wasn't going to make it, you know. And finally this guy stopped, and he had a brand new 47 Chevrolet. And they got in, the heater was going. And he said, I'll take you to, where are you going? I said, Oklahoma. He said, well, I'll take you to Lubbock for $5. And I said, I don't have $5. He said, I guess you won't get to go to Lubbock then. I had a switchblade knife in my pocket, and I released the switchblade button there, and I wasn't going to get out of that car. I was too sick. I just wasn't going to get out. And I woke up. He took me to Paris. Then a town just south of the Texas border. And I got back over into Oklahoma, and I was really sick. And then that summer, I lasted the summer, and my brother owned the farm, and he hired me to run his tractor with him to pull a combine. And so he paid me off. I don't know how much he gave me, but I was up to Pawhuska, Oklahoma, at this Kettleman's bar. And I went in there, and I was drinking a beer, and it's... About every 2 weeks, this Navy recruiter from Oklahoma City would come down and try to recruit somebody. And he'd come to the bar, and I always had a close-cut haircut, and I had a Stevie shirt on, and my tattoos were showing, and he said, are you on leave? And I said, no, I got out. And he said, oh, I said, you need to come back in. He said, everybody bailed out, said, you can make chief in 6 months. You come back in. So, you know, I had another beer. He bought me some more beer, you know. He went across the street and he came back and he said, you made 100 on that entrance exam. What's your name? Just sign your name down there. And so I followed the car and we went to Hattiesburg, Oklahoma City. And, you know, it's like then, like in California, ever, you know, had a beer joint every mile or so, you know. And we stopped at all of them. And that SOB wanted me to drive. I said, no, I don't think so. I was drunk, but I wasn't that drunk to drive a Navy vehicle, you know. But anyway, I got back in the Navy, and they sent me to San Diego to again, another receiving station, and we had to wait a couple of weeks to get our shots reoriented and had to get vaccinated. And that time, we got our uniforms again, and 2 weeks is up, I got my uniform out of the cleaner. I got some poor marks in the Navy for conduct and things like that, but I always had a good mark in my military brain because I love my uniform. You know, I got in that uniform, I got paid, by the way. I heard it paid, and uniform and liberty. And I went over in San Diego that night and Sailor Row over there, and man, just like I'd never left the Navy. It is beautiful. You know, I loved everything about the bars. Old shit kicking music and the lovely ladies, you know, and they was real friendly most of them, and you know, it's just beautiful. And I got drunk and the shore patrol took me back. That's how I come back to the Navy. Anyway, I know it sounds like more of a sailor log I got than a drunk log, but anyway, I got back out in the Pacific and I wound up, by the way, on the Riskany. That's the one that McCain was flew off of the last one. He shot down over Vietnam. Anyway, we got back to the States, and I got short duty in San Diego. And I just figured, you know, getting a part-time job and getting one of these beautiful little girls and getting married and have a little white, you know, house with a white picket fence around, you know, and a couple of hound dogs, you know. I could just picture that. It didn't hardly work out that way. I got in the bar. And I got drunk. So I think I had 9 years in the Navy, and I was sitting on a bus stop bank at 5th and El Cajon in San Diego. And you know, it was on a Sunday morning, and these cars were stopping at the stop sign. And the ladies were dressed up so pretty, and the little kids were dressed up, and the guys had on a coat and tie. And I said, God damn, that's my trouble. I need a wife. Married men don't get drunk, you know, like us single guys. So I went downtown San Diego and sitting in all the bars, you know, and telling the girls my plan, and they said that's crazy. One of them said that her divorce would be final in a month, and she'd marry me, but she was kind of cosmetically unattractive. I thought, But I went on down to another bar and there was Catherine. Now, Catherine and I had known each other for a long time. And we'd checked out a lot of issues in these motel rooms, you know. And she thought that was a splendid idea to get married, you know. So she was going to go to Yuma to get married. You know, we didn't have cars. So she said, right, they did take us over and bear witness. Well, going over there, we had this cooler full of beer. You know, I was just heaven, just, you know, just, I just knew, boy, this is going to be some kind of marriage, you know. We got into Yuma, we lost the chief and his wife somewhere, and so these other people said they'd be aware of this for us. And I don't remember the wedding, but they said it was splendid. But one thing I do remember, they had to have a tuxedo on, and I didn't have one, so they had these paper ones that drench you. Well, what happened was, sat in this motel room, one of them had the double of the door going into another room, you know. I woke up the next morning, hungover, my head in an ashtray, and everybody was drunk, passed out, and would you believe my new bride, there was two guys that sleep alongside her in this bed. You know, they was really taking good care of me. And I said to myself, I don't think his marriage is going to last too long. Do you know how much God loves me? I looked across the street and there was a bar open. And I found it over in my tuxedo. And I hope none of you ever drink again. If you go in a bar at 6 o'clock in the morning with a tuxedo, the worse for wear, you're not going to buy a drink. You know. Anyway, sitting in there, and pretty soon there was one of the girls in the waiting party come over and we started drinking. Then pretty soon all of them started drifting in. Pretty soon, these two nice gentlemen that's courting a bride over there, you know. So then this girl is, you know, she's worried about that somebody probably left a lady's cigarette in an ashtray and afraid to set burn a motel down. So we went back over to check it, make sure there wasn't any cigarette butts in the ashtray, okay. After that, it got a little, anyway. We had to come back in the bus and just to west of, anyway, just west of San Diego, the town, El Centro. And I threw up all over the back of the bus. I was crapped out back in that bench, you know. And the bus driver wouldn't, said we couldn't go on into San Diego to clean up that mess. Well, I could carry less. I still had to leave, but she had to go to work the next day, so she cleaned it up. Coming all the way into San Diego, she kept looking back and glaring at me. You know, I thought, well, you one way bitch, will you ask a favor out of me? You know? Anyway, I think the name of that marriage type was Marriage is Made in Heaven. That wasn't really. They say that two drunks can't communicate. Bullshit. We did just fine. Get up in the morning, go to the bathroom, get out of the way, whore, shut up, bastard. You know. And after that, our relationship would deteriorate just a little bit more during the day. And we just drink this pop-out vodka, vodka and instant coffee just to get us jump started. That marriage didn't last. Anyway, I wound up back in Japan on a ship. It was home portage in Yokosuka. And while I was on that ship, some sailor stole a Marine captain's Jeep at the main gate and drove it down the pier. And there's a big hole where they drove it off in this hole and just pancaked. And these two nearsighted Marines came aboard and picked me out of the 1,400 men. They said I was the F.O. they had done it. Couldn't believe it, you know, innocently. So I had to go over to his base provost marshal's office. That's the same as a D.A. And it's really shitty getting up on you to hang, you know. And all is over. This little Japanese girl worked in the office there. And I don't know, she had the saddest, brownest, prettiest eyes I ever seen, you know. And, but anyway, they quit me because they couldn't get enough evidence. And this commander called me in and he said, don't you ever get close to this place again. If you do, I'm kicking you out of my Navy. So I went to meet this girl, but I didn't dare go back over. I was afraid they'd haul me out on something, you know. So I went out to the kitchen bus, and there she was waiting on the bus. And I sweet-talked her into going over to the M Club with me, and got over. all these guys are laughing how we screwed that Marines up, you know. They're bragging on about how I stole that Jeep. She says later they should have told her something to them. Anyway, we got ordered down to Okinawa, and by that time I was really drinking heavy. I got orders for Lemoore, California. And no one had ever heard of Lemoore, California. Somebody got it mixed up with Livermore, you know. But anyway, I looked it up in the encyclopedia, and here's what it said. Lemoore, California sits in the beautiful San Joaquin Valley, surrounded by rivers and lakes and forests. And I told my wife, let's get that sleep bag. We're going to heaven, you know. So I bought a car, and we come back up old 99, and I seen the sign Livermore, and I took the left around Houston, you know, and we drove, and we drove, and we drove. All I seen was a cow manure and hay bales, you know. And I told my wife, this can't be no sailor's hair, my God, you know. So we stopped over at 12th and Houston to regroup, and my boy and my wife was crying. I wanted to, but anyway. I got my boy a fist of milk and her big cola. I got me a big cold beer, you know. Sure enough, that was Lemoore. So we got on out there, and you know, they just building the base, and it was dusty and hot, and everybody looked like they had a terminal case of hemorrhoids, you know. I didn't find anybody smiling, you know. And I told my wife, man, we'll never retire here. Anyway, I got retired in 1965 in the Navy, and can you believe that the exchange officer gave me a job as manager of the M-Sub? $20,000 worth of booze over, and I had the key saw, you know. It's like putting a jackrabbit in a carrot patch, hoping he wouldn't eat any carrots, you know. So it got worse and worse and worse, and they sent me to Alameda, their club, and it got worse and worse, and finally in early 72, I come back down to Lemoore, and, well, by the way, my wife had joined Alameda. You guys want to quit drinking forever. Don't let your wife join Alamont. She'll screw that up so bad, you know. You'll never join it. An Alamont, they can pulverize your husband at 40 feet. They got them beady eyes, you know, and the lips get thin, and it's just like smoke coming out of each side, you know. And somehow or another, I don't know how to do it, but they draw you about a foot at a time. They draw you right up. They get right up in your face and they say, you son of a bitch, you know. Don't ever let them join that one. Anyway, you know what? I found out that I went through treatment in the VA hospital. And so I wanted that wife and boys back so bad, you know. I'd call her up and I'd say she wasn't anxious, so I'd hang up, you know. But finally one night I got brave and I let her ring through and she said, yeah, come on. No condition, just gone. That's what I didn't know. Not only had she joined Al-Anon, she'd also followed me through my treatment program. And she kept tabs on how it was done, so it kind of saved me. And I remember we sat up on the couch all night crying and hugging, you know. And I promised my God that night that I never again would hurt her in any way. Intentionally. Intentionally. Never hurt her again. And I've tried to do that. I've tried to do something nice for her every day of my life since then. She can't always do things. But at least I try not to hurt her, you know. Anyway, when I got in treatment, they got me in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, they took me to these meetings, and I don't even remember where the meetings was. Since then, I know where they're at now because I went back to them. But I didn't understand what you people was talking about. You people was talking crazy. Clean up your act, make amends, you know. All that kind of stuff. Unheard of. But I don't know, I was in a meeting one night and I heard something that brought me back the next night and brought me back the next night and brought me back the next night. And pretty soon I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I could see where you guys were driving up here in late model cars and dressed nice. I wanted some of that. I wanted that. And so he told me there was a way, you know. I just listened. And what happened was that there 2 or 3 months, I become an AA pain in the ass, you know. I'd stop people in the street and tell them where the meeting was. Give them a copy of the 12-step. It's the one that didn't lock me up. But And I've heard other people say this too. You know, I got on the bus and other people have had this same experience. I sat down with this little gray-haired lady and I said, I had about 4 months sober, I guess. I said, it's been about a year since I had a drink of alcohol. She said, well, it's been 68 years since I had one. I thought, well, that's you, Grandma. And I bought this preacher a big book over in Lemoore because it didn't seem to me like he was grasping this spiritual thing we got. You know, if you're new, this program is a wondrous, God-given program, and that's all I can say. You know, I wound up, I didn't tell you, I didn't have time. I wound up living in a medical pickup before I got to that hospital. And through sobriety, I was able to buy a home, pay for it. And a few months ago, my wife and I moved in to the Rendon. It's a retirement center in Hanbury. You talk about class. You know, once you pay your rent, everything else is paid for you. That's your phone. The servers bring you food to the table, and oh, man, that's living. It's a long way from that farm back in Oklahoma to the Rendon, I'll tell you. But it can happen to anybody, okay? If you just keep coming back, and please, I tell every newcomer, stay around till you find out how sick you are. If you leave before you find out how sick you are, you're not going to make it, you know? Somewhere along the line, you'll realize that we're not bad people trying to get good, we're sick people trying to get well. You know? And so stick around. Stick around for them. It won't cost you anything. You don't even put a dollar in the kitty if you don't want to. Of course, somebody's always looking at you, you know. But it's God-given, you know. It's it never amazes me to see the diversity of our members. You know, actually, very few members have a whole lot in common with other members. When you leave here, you scatter in all kinds of directions, and you don't see anybody in the next meeting, you know. All races, religions, political affiliations, sexual orientation. Nobody gives a damn. They don't care who you are. Just come back. Come back and support us in sobriety, okay? And that's what they do, you know. We come back every night, these meetings supporting each other. And your newcomer, first of all, you had the 22 days? Did you have the 22 days? You know, you amazed me. When I had 22 days, I couldn't even say my name. I'd let's get up here and... That's wonderful. That's wonderful. You know, actually, the members are getting smarter now. They're coming in a little younger. The brains haven't been beat up so bad. They haven't went so far down. And so they can realize, you know, they look around and they hear other people. And they realize, you know, there's a way out of this mess. You know, people try church, and there's nothing wrong with church. That's our conscience of our country, the churches. But you know, we have a crude sin in Alcoholics Anonymous. You go to church to save your soul. You come to A to save your ass. And it's just that important, okay? Churches was never designed to treat alcoholics. Not the ones I went through, huh? In fact, I think they made a few alcoholics out of us, you know. But just keep coming back. Try it. You know, I got, like I say, when I got here, you talking crazy. I didn't know what you were talking about. But everything you told me, you know, I looked around the sign and said, easy does it, first things first. You know, don't get in the piston contest. If you don't want to stink, don't get in the piston contest with a skunk. All kinds of good things, you know. That really made sense, you know. Simple thing. You know, Father Martin says there's a lot of people too smart to get sober, but he never seems anybody too dumb to. You know, sometimes it takes to be dumb, I think, in this program. You don't have to worry about it. You see people come in, they want to rewrite the big book. It's not road right, you know. They usually don't last. But there's only one reason that you're ever going to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's if you want to. If you don't want to, you'll never get sober. And you can't just say, I want to get sober. You got to want to get sober. You want that more than anything. You want that more than your wife, your home, your job. Because without your sobriety, you're not going to have those other things. Because sooner or later, that wife's going to lose your home. that wife's going to leave you, and on and on and on. So sobriety has got to be our main priority. Our main priority. Without that, you know. I would just like to say for the newcomers tonight, you know, at most meetings, when they close the meeting, they hold hands and they say a prayer. And a lot of newcomers, you know, they feel real uncomfortable. So they hold them hands and say a prayer. Don't worry about it. We're not here to judge your beliefs or non-beliefs. Just step back out of the room. That's okay. Now, nobody's going to get mad at you. All we want you to do is keep coming back so we can help you get sober. We can't help you get sober if you don't come back. But we don't care about who you are or what you are, you know. If you think you're the craziest one in the room, you might have some competition, you know. You know, it says in the book, you know, some of us suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But we too could get sober if we just stuck around and got honest and worked the program, okay? And I've seen some bad cases walk through that door. And a year or so later, they've got a job back. That's another thing in AA that I love is a one-year birthday. I love them all, but to me, a one-year birthday is kind of spiritual. Here's a guy that couldn't get sober. Tried everything in the world to get sober and couldn't. And yet he comes in AA, and a year later, he's celebrating a year of sobriety. And if it's a woman, you'll hear him say, "Judge, give me the kids back." If it's a guy, you'll say, "I got my job back," or "I signed up for West Hills College." Now people are, they want to get back with it. You know, they want to progress and make something out of life. And it's not easy. This is a simple program, but I wouldn't say it's an easy program. Not when you're sitting there shaking and wanting to drink. Wanting some speaker to shut up. It's not always easy. But it works. I don't know. I guess a few minutes. Anybody got any questions they'd like to ask me? By the way, I had 36 years sober last November. Is there some question you'd like to ask?
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
Right?
What's
this? Did you marry that secretary?
Did I marry?
Did you marry her?
Mm-mm. No. Oh, yeah. The Japanese girl? Yeah. 50 years ago last August, we married the same woman. First of all, I never did have enough money to get divorced. And the second thing, after you're married a while, just quit talking to each other. It makes it a lot easier. You get along a lot better if you don't talk to each other. That's what you said about, if you've ever raised teenage kids, you know why animals eat their young, right? Okay, I guess.
I think we've got one more question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Don't be bashful.
No.
I might not even answer for you. It might be the wrong one. Okay. Thank you for putting up with me.